It's Labor Day weekend, and this year anyway, that means asking, is mass deportation really the answer to America's and Florida's undocumented labor situation? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. We're devoting the next hour to the realities and myths of our undocumented migrant workers. President Trump is out to demonize them and expel them for good. It's not likely he can do that, but even if he could, what then? Especially in Florida, a state where today there are only 53 available workers for every 100 available jobs, and a state where undocumented migrants pay some $2 billion in taxes. Should we evict these folks or embrace them? Our discussion coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. So much of our community conversation this year has been about immigration, specifically President Trump's sweeping crackdown on immigration, that we just thought it made sense on this Labor Day weekend to discuss our migrant labor reality. A significant portion of Florida's labor is undocumented, more than 40% in agriculture. That means much of our economy depends on labor that is technically here illegally and therefore technically deportable in an instant. So we're devoting today's program to that rather dysfunctional situation. Where would we be economically without those undocumented migrant workers, especially as America's working-age population and its birth rate decline? Just as important, should we be finding ways to make more of them documented? Our first guest, David Beer, is the Director of Immigration Studies at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank in Washington, D.C., and he testified before Congress this year with just that argument. David, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
In a conversation you and I had earlier this year, you made the point that if you tell migrant workers there's no way to come legally, the message is sent that the only way to come is illegally. You've said that we've become so obsessed with confronting the illegal immigration situation in this country that we've lost sight of the need for more legal immigration options. Can you elaborate a little on what you mean by that and how you see that reality playing out in America today?
Well, you look at the legal immigration system in the United States, and in order to immigrate permanently to the country, you need something called a green card, which allows you to stay and receive legal permanent residence here. We issue about 1 million of those per year, but because of the fact that that limit was set in 1990, we've had this huge demand build up over time to the point where last year, just 3% of the people who were trying to go through the permanent legal immigration system were actually allowed to receive a green card. So that shows how constrained our system is, how out of date it is, how in need of reform it is, and how impossible it is for most people who want to immigrate. And of course, it's not a random 3%. It's almost entirely people with close family ties to U.S. citizens or legal permanent residents. Almost 80% are family-based immigrants who are able to immigrate legally through those pathways. If you don't fit in one of those categories, look, you're really out of luck. There's not an option for you to come, particularly if you don't have an advanced degree, STEM skills, things like that. And when you look at the low-skilled part of the immigration system, that's the system where most of these people, they're coming, they're looking for work in industries and jobs not requiring a college degree. We have two temporary work visas available for people who don't have a college degree. And those are for the H-2A and H-2B, and they're for agriculture and non-agricultural jobs that are temporary or seasonal. And that's a key point. It's only if it's a temporary or seasonal job. And so the vast majority of the jobs in the U.S. economy don't fit that categorization system. And so there's no way for employers to hire people legally on a temporary visa.
So I should point out that in recent weeks, President Trump seems to agree with your assertion that we need more year-round worker visas in this country for jobs that don't, as you say, require college degrees, especially in sectors like agriculture. You mentioned the seasonal worker visa programs, but a lot of critics say there's not enough of it and it involves too much bureaucratic red tape. So just how deficient would you say our visa system is for migrant workers, not only in the farming sector, but others like construction and hospitality? And what's the best way, to your mind, to augment it for, as you've said, the needs of the 21st century?
Well, look, there's 14 million people in the country who are here illegally or with a status that the administration is canceling now, and they'll be illegally here shortly. And so when you look at, you know, we have an H-2B visa, the cap for that is set at $65,000 per year. And we're talking about millions and millions of people who are here illegally. There's just no way to jam them into that type of system. The agricultural visa, again, it's just for temporary or seasonal jobs. So that's nothing for dairies, nothing for poultry processing, nothing that's going to be a year-round position is available. And when you look at all the people who came in under the last 4 years of the Biden administration, where did they go? They all went into these types of jobs in hospitality and restaurants and construction, all these industries and with huge numbers of job openings where they couldn't find workers, and there was no way to hire people legally. And the result was, you know, huge numbers of people working illegally.
You argue, David, that because Congress keeps failing to engage substantive immigration reform, we've become too reliant in this country on temporary stopgap solutions like amnesty and temporary protected status, or TPS, and humanitarian parole. But how badly in the long run do you see the economy of states like Florida be impacted by this rather dysfunctional situation if Congress doesn't move to fix it?
Well, it's going to be an enormously negative impact, particularly if the mass deportation plan goes forward. It's going to disrupt industries really across the entire United States, but highly concentrated in Miami and southern Florida generally. I mean, that is an area where huge numbers of people came in under parole. Hundreds of thousands of people entered legally and came there, and now they're losing that status. And also people came illegally, and the Trump administration's going to remove them. That's going to have really negative consequences, both in terms of the workforce and production in those areas. It's really going to harm business creation there, but it's also going to harm consumption, which is fueling these businesses to expand in Florida. If you lose the people who are your customers, that means you're going to have to downsize and lay people off.
And I guess specifically I'd ask, how urgent then does this make it for Congress to engage bills like the Dignity Act, sponsored by Miami Congresswoman Maria Elvira Salazar, that in many ways seems to acknowledge these migrant worker realities that we're talking about?
It's critical that something must be done. The Dignity Act, that is one important step forward to create a way for people to get in a line and get on the right side of the law, prove that they're not a threat to the community, that they have something to offer. And in return, they get dignity, they get a status to stay here. It's not something that is about citizenship and voting rights. It's just about solving the immediate need, the economic need of the United States. And so it's a great step forward. We need to comprehensively look at the legal immigration system, but there's some improvements there within the bill as well. And so this is a starting point for Congress to really move forward on this conversation.
Now, you've also made the point that during President Trump's first term from 2017 to 2021, he slashed legal immigration. Asylum, for example, was down about 90%, but that there was more illegal immigration as a result. Tell us more about how you saw that dynamic play out.
Well, during the first Trump administration, he did not decrease the number of people who were crossing the border illegally. In fact, it was generally an upwards trend, really, from 2017, 2018, 2019. It was all a big growth. It went down during 2020. And then by the end of 2020, It was already higher than when he came into office in terms of the number of Border Patrol arrests. Obviously, it spiked dramatically after that to unprecedented highs under Biden. But the point is that this is really has been a longstanding problem. He thinks he's resolved it now and it's the end of the problem. It's been a few months. We'll see how long this current hiatus lasts. But the long-term solution, the best solution for the United States is to have a legal immigration system that's functional.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with David Beer of the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. on the need to expand access to worker visas in this country, especially in the sort of economic sectors that migrant workers keep afloat in states like Florida, like agriculture and tourism. David, I'm curious to know your assessment of the immediate and long-term need for more non-college degree worker visas when we look, for example, at factors like the decline of our working age population and our low birth rate. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, for example, recently reported there are only 53 available workers for every 100 open jobs in Florida. Is this situation reflected around the rest of the country?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And look, when you talk about the decline in the number of workers, I mean, we went from a situation where Social Security had almost a dozen workers in the 1940s supporting each retiree to now having a situation where we have fewer than two workers supporting each retiree. And it's, poised to go even lower. And at that point, who's going to be paying for that system? It's just going to be paid for entirely in debt, which is going to be an incredible burden on the economy, a huge drag on growth, and ultimately make everyone in the United States much poorer. In order to fix the problem, in order to get to the point where revenues are equal to expenses in the Social Security system, just to give you the scale of the population issue that we're dealing with, we need about 30 million additional workers in the system by the mid-2030s. So that's an enormous deficit, but it's a manageable one if you had a better legal immigration system to help fill these open jobs.
So I want to reach back a little to the 1980s when then President Ronald Reagan, a conservative Republican, forged an immigration reform that essentially handed amnesty to undocumented migrants under a certain set of conditions. Congresswoman Salazar's Dignity Act that we discussed earlier would in some ways do the same thing. But can you help us understand why Reagan's major move in 1986 was so widely accepted? And more important, how legalizing all that new migrant labor ended up benefiting the U.S. economy at that time?
Well, it was accepted because it was understood that there was not going to be a mass deportation plan that would carry out the removal of all of these people. And so it's a much better option to provide them a way to engage legally with the economy. Obviously, that has changed over time as people have adopted different views on this issue. It was demonstrably beneficial to the country to have done that, have a legal way for them to work. It was overwhelmingly in agriculture at that time. And if you look at the situation today, with respect to U.S. farms, a huge number of the people who are still working on those farms are either the workers who were amnestied back in 1986 or the children of those people who are now on those farms. So it's been an important source of labor for the United States. And really, those laborers are providing a lot of value to the country.
Similarly, we can also point back to 1990 and 1996, the last time this country ever passed substantive immigration reform.
Well, it's interesting when you look at the 1996 Act, that was the principal provision of that that has really had the most lasting impact is the fact that it prohibited people who had come in illegally or were here illegally from going home and then getting a visa to come back if they were eligible for a visa for at least 10 years, which meant that it's basically impossible for any of these people to, go home and enter legally again. They're not going to leave under those conditions. So what ended up happening, of course, is that they just stayed in the United States and built their lives here rather than going home and trying to, you know, come back the right way. And that's a significant problem. You know, you have to change that law if you want to fix the legal immigration system and you want people to self-deport and, you know, get on the right side of the law. You need to have the incentive structure right. And we really don't have that incentive structure in place, both because we don't have a legal immigration system that works, but also because of the 1996 law that prohibits them from being able to access any kind of legal immigration, even if they're married to a U.S. citizen. I think many people don't understand that part of it. You know, we have almost 2 million people who are married to U.S. citizens who can't get legal. They can't get a green card, even though they're an immediate relative of a U.S. citizen. And that's really a crime against family unity that our laws are that way.
So, David, the reality is it's been three decades since Congress produced any meaningful immigration reform. So I guess my last question then is, in the 21st century, when we consider how globalized the economy and especially labor has become, can any country, especially a major power like the United States, afford to let immigration reform wait that long?
We've seen many countries go down the path of population decline and, you know, ignore this issue and just forget about it and think, well, we're going to figure it out, or you know, we're going to have some other way to deal with it, or maybe technology will fix it, or maybe we can increase the birth rate somehow. They've come up with all these different schemes. They've never worked out, and population decline has just continued on its path, and we end up with this huge population of retirees who aren't contributing to the economy. They're taking in huge amounts in benefits, and it's politically unfeasible to rein in the spending that we provide to the elderly in this country. So what's the solution? The only way to get to a better position on this is to have a legal immigration system that allows people to come and work. And of course, you know, we're pursuing the exact opposite policy. You know, the worst possible situation is mass deportation combined with restrictions on legal immigration. And that's really what we're seeing right now under the Trump administration. And so can we afford it? Well, I mean, it depends on how you look at it. Yes, we're a very rich country, but we can make ourselves poorer by pursuing these types of policies. We've seen countries do that in the past, but it's not a good idea.
David Beer is Director of Immigration Studies at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. David, many thanks as always.
Thank you.
Still to come, what do we gain from undocumented labor, and what would we lose if it disappeared? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. We're devoting this Labor Day program to the migrant labor situation here, especially undocumented migrant labor, whose benefits and burdens are, of course, subjects of fierce debate this year. It's uncomfortable for most Americans to acknowledge that few of us would sign on to do the essential jobs in vegetable fields, construction sites, and hotel rooms that undocumented workers will do. And it's just as awkward when we learn what our economy gains from that reality. Last year, the nonprofit Florida Policy Institute in Orlando estimated a new state law cracking down on undocumented labor could cost Florida's economy almost $13 billion. Meanwhile, the Nonprofit Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, or ITEP, reports undocumented workers in Florida contribute almost $2 billion in taxes. Right now, we'll talk with analysts from those organizations, starting with Alexis Tsoukalos, a senior policy analyst at the Florida Policy Institute, who spoke with me from St. Petersburg. Alexis, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You and the Florida Policy Institute last year made an eye-opening assessment of what a new state law targeting undocumented labor would cost the Florida economy, about $12.6 billion in its first year. What sort of criteria was that estimate based on that you feel we need to be paying attention to as the state continues to crack down on undocumented workers?
We do feel this is likely a conservative estimate for various reasons, but we are focused on the share of undocumented people in key industries in Florida. Of course, with data, when you're dealing with groups who are undocumented, there's always a caveat, is that because by the nature of their status, they're not always necessarily going to be easily counted and standing up to be counted. But based on estimates that we have, we know that Florida has six industries that are really key to our state, and undocumented people make up almost 400,000 workers within those industries. That is construction primarily, and then there's professional administrative services. That includes a host of different fields. Of course, accommodation and hospitality, which is significantly important to the state, retail and other services like domestic work, and then of course, agriculture. What we did was we looked at the share of estimated undocumented workers in those fields and what would happen if, based on SB 1718 in 2023, or based on mass deportation policies going on now, we no longer had those workers in our state. And that's where we came up with that figure of $12.6 billion in lost wages because of how much they contribute to the economy and our gross domestic product.
And I should point out SB 1718, you're referring to one of those state laws that would crack down, as we said, on undocumented labor in the state. I would imagine that impact would be felt most in Florida's agriculture industry, obviously, where almost half the labor force is undocumented. How seriously does that sector stand to be impacted if we do end up seeing a significant disappearance of that labor? And at the same time, if we don't see significant immigration reform that leads to more legalization of that labor force?
As you said, as much as half of the agriculture industry is made up of undocumented workers, to our understanding. The other issue I just want to point out is a lot of these laws, state and federal, they're designed to target so-called undocumented immigrants. But one thing that we've continually pointed out and that advocates have is someone's documentation status can change. It's not always that black and white. And if you are targeting undocumented people, you might be targeting their family members who actually are legally in this state, or their spouses or their children. And so it's really hard to discern how wide ranging the impacts can be. Agriculture in particular is interesting because just like California, Florida is a huge state for agriculture. It's one of our top industries. We're a large exporter of things like strawberries and oranges to other parts of the country. If we don't have a labor force to support it, not only is that going to impact our revenue because we can't sell these products, it's going to impact the economy here in general. And people might end up going to the grocery store now and having to pay a little bit more because now we don't have that locally produced quality agriculture like we're so used to. In 2023, when this law passed, we did see some legislators who had voted in favor of it come back afterward and actually say, please don't leave the state. We need you. We need these workers.
As President Trump himself seems to have acknowledged in recent weeks, no?
I wasn't aware he had. Yeah, did he?
He's been making noises about how, maybe I'll make concessions here for agriculture workers. Yeah.
I'm sure some of that, it could be the business community is speaking up and letting them know this as well. But it's something new that we are reliant on immigrant labor for a lot of our key industry. At the very least, anyone who is here and contributing to our society, whether economically or just through their inherent values, we should be welcoming them and not kicking them out of the state.
But the argument always arises, and on the face of it, it would seem to make economic sense. And that's the argument that as long as we allow so many impoverished migrants willing to work for such low wages into our workforce, it ends up depressing workers' wages for the legal workforce. Does that argument really add up in the Florida context, though?
So we talked about this when it came to the minimum wage. Anytime wages are artificially low or suppressed in any industry, it's obviously not ideal in the long run. You don't want a huge low-income workforce because it can bring down, as you said, wages for other industries. Mm-hmm. That being said, I think this is a false dichotomy. We can have better paying jobs, as I said. We can have people wanting to do this work and have stronger protections, but still not relegate it to only people who are born in the country or only people who have been here for so many years. I think it should matter more about their skills, their willingness to work, and their willingness to contribute to society.
Earlier this year, Governor DeSantis wanted to relax child labor laws in Florida as a way of filling the state's worker deficit with legal labor. You told a Senate committee, however, that this was a troubling reach and not good for the social health of Florida teenagers. But if this is the Republicans' only answer to the legal labor shortfall in this state, would this seem to suggest that we need to find new ways to make more illegal labor legal?
I think really stepping back and taking a larger picture, to me, it's not even about legal versus illegal. It's a larger picture of exploitation. So what you're doing when you say children should be doing this job instead of undocumented people, you're really just subbing out one exploited group for another. And the ideal is we're not exploiting anybody. Florida has long been a state that's very anti-worker, that's very anti-union, and now, unfortunately, anti-immigrant. And those all play together. Yeah, that's definitely not the solution. Obviously, a pathway to citizenship at the federal level would be a phenomenal start. But as we've seen with programs like the DACA program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival, those laws are always in limbo because it always depends on what administration is in power and what they decide to do.
You've also made the argument, Alexis, that it was a mistake for Florida this year to prohibit undocumented students from receiving cheaper in-state tuition to attend public colleges and universities. And it seemed the thrust of your argument was that this actually ends up costing the state more in the long run. What exactly were you getting at?
Right. The reason that we were very much opposed was because what's really going to happen is this undocumented person now is no longer going to enroll in college because they most likely are not going to be able to afford double to triple the tuition costs. And, you know, there's this argument that, well, no, we'll actually make money because they're going to pay more. Well, no, the reality is most likely they're going to leave the state completely or stay here and not get a college education and not be able to fully contribute to our economy. So we're actually going to lose out on that revenue, right, and it's going to go to another state or, you know, in the long run, our economy will lose out.
Alexis Tsoukalos is a senior policy analyst at the Florida Policy Institute. Alexis, many thanks.
Thank you.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. We're talking about the economic contribution that undocumented labor makes to Florida. And I'd like to turn now to our conversation this week with Marco Guzman, a senior policy analyst at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy in Washington, D.C. Marco, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let me just start by asking you, what is the estimate today of the tax contribution that undocumented migrant workers make to both the U.S. and the state of Florida?
Yeah, in 2022, we estimate that undocumented immigrants contribute about $97 billion to state, local, and federal taxes across the country. In Florida, undocumented immigrants contribute about $1.8 billion in 2022, but that's a yearly estimate. So they contribute that amount roughly every year.
Right. So almost $2 billion. So that almost $100 billion nationwide and that almost $2 billion statewide here in Florida, did that number surprise you?
It did. Undocumented immigrants, they are very clearly working. They're contributing significantly to their states and local communities. In Florida, undocumented immigrants, a majority of the revenue that they contribute to the state comes in the form of sales and excise taxes.
Right, because we have no state income tax in Florida. Right?
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Yeah. So sales and excise taxes make up a significant chunk, but also property taxes. They pay about $725 million in property taxes.
Wow. Now, that one I don't think many people saw coming. Yeah. I think most Americans, though, when they hear about the tax contribution that undocumented migrants make in states like Florida and nationwide, their first question is, how do undocumented workers end up paying taxes if they are undocumented? Can you walk us through, for example, how an undocumented construction worker from Central America pays Social Security taxes when he doesn't even have a Social Security number, probably?
Yeah, they pay taxes in the form of income taxes. Some of them pay with what the IRS provides them. It's called an ITIN or an individual taxpayer identification number.
Right.
But sometimes undocumented immigrants, like you said, they may not have a Social Security number. They may use an old Social Security number. They may use a fake one, but they're still paying, because they have that work, they're paying payroll taxes.
Right.
And that's another important tax that they're paying. And these are the taxes that are taken from their monthly withholding when they get checks from work. That goes to things like Social Security, Medicare, unemployment insurance. And importantly, those are programs that they are undocumented immigrants are all prohibited from accessing.
Right. And to reiterate what you were mentioning earlier, in a state like Florida, where we have no state income tax, what sort of sales tax contribution do groups like ITEP estimate undocumented workers make to the economy as customers and consumers? And when we talk about that almost $2 billion tax contribution that you noted undocumented migrants make to the state of Florida, is most of that in the form of sales tax?
It is. That is the major source of tax that undocumented immigrants pay in Florida, or I should say over $1 billion. They are purchasing things like utilities, goods and services, all taxable purchases, all contributions from undocumented immigrants that help, fill the coffers of Florida's overall revenues.
Right. And then the question is, if those undocumented workers are paying taxes, whether it be Social Security, payroll, sales taxes, et cetera, what do they get in return? Do they derive any public benefit from the revenue they send to our federal and state coffers?
Oftentimes they don't. Like I said, they're not eligible for things like the earned income tax credit at the federal level. And the Trump administration has been steadily adding eligibility requirements for the child tax credit at the federal level.
And you also mentioned that undocumented migrants are not eligible to derive any Medicaid or Medicare benefits in that regard either, right?
Correct. Yeah, they are prohibited from things like unemployment insurance. They are prohibited from Medicare. But again, their payroll taxes do help fund these programs. So essentially, we're getting free money from undocumented immigrants for these programs.
But the other question, of course, becomes from the other side, is whatever tax contribution undocumented workers are making, is it canceled out or even overtaken by the public services they do end up using in our midst, such as an emergency room treatment or public schools or something as simple but nonetheless meaningful as weekly garbage collection? Is there just myth or is there some truth to the claim that the undocumented migrant is, let's say, a parasite in that regard?
Yeah, the overwhelming research shows that undocumented immigrants, their contributions, tax contributions, significantly outweigh the services that they end up taking in. In many cases, undocumented immigrants may not feel comfortable seeking medical care, and so they're not using those services as much as the native-born population. And, it's billions and billions of dollars that undocumented immigrants are contributing to states and local economies to help with those services, every day.
Now, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce recently estimated that because of the shrinking of the working age population in this country and our declining birth rate, there are only 53 available workers for every 100 jobs that need to be filled here in Florida. But that would seem to be not just a labor problem, but a tax problem as well, no? And I mean, given everything we've just been talking about, Marco, it would seem that we need that migrant labor to keep our tax coffers and our Social Security coffers viable as well.
Yeah, immigration just in general is incredibly important to a country's health. That continued influx of labor, they help care for the generation ahead of them. A state like Florida, if they're cracking down on undocumented immigrants, you could run the risk of Florida needing to raise revenue in other ways. They would have to increase the sales tax. And so, that's placing more of a burden on native-born legal residents in Florida. Our estimate shows that undocumented immigrants' contributions would increase from $97 billion to about $137 billion if they were given legal status.
Marco Guzman is a senior policy analyst at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy in Washington, D.C. Marco, thank you very much again.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, a look inside the undocumented migrant labor community. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Paget. For this Labor Day program, we've been discussing an issue that's gripped this country and this state all year, and that's undocumented migrant labor. There are an estimated 1.6 million undocumented migrants in Florida, the third largest share in the U.S. But while the Trump administration has been on a campaign to cast undocumented migrants as criminals, the fact is the vast majority are not. They're hardworking and usually tax-paying community members in spite of their illegal immigration status. So we also wanted to speak with someone who works closely with undocumented migrant workers here to separate that community reality from the new criminal myth. Jeannie Economos is the Pesticide and Environmental Health Project Coordinator for the nonprofit Farm Worker Association of Florida. She spoke to me from Apopka in Central Florida. Jeannie, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I want to start with your focus there at the Farm Workers Association of Florida, which is pesticides and other worker safety issues. When we consider that almost half the agricultural labor force in this state is undocumented, and undocumented labor works largely under the regulatory radar, how much more important does it become to make sure farmers and the agricultural industry here don't become complacent about the sort of protective rules that documented labor can perhaps take for granted?
Well, it's always a problem. It has been for decades, getting enforcement of protections for farm workers around pesticides, exposure, around heat stress, which of course we don't have any heat stress regulations in the state. It's always been a problem, but we're very afraid now that it's going to be increasingly a problem because, you know, the workforce is under threat and people are afraid to speak out. People are afraid to say anything. People are afraid to go to work, period. Mm-hmm. But if when they do go to work, they're so desperate for, you know, having a job, being able to support their families. So they're not going to complain if some of the regulations are violated.
Right.
I've spent 30 years working with farm workers, and we have in the past made complaints on behalf of farm workers when there's violations of pesticide regulations. Mm-hmm. And I will say that during the first Trump administration, people were so afraid. We got almost no complaints from farm workers because they were more concerned about being able to come home to their children in the evenings, making sure that their family members were safe, that their kids were safe in school, that they weren't going to get deported. And we're seeing the same thing now.
Aside from the rather backbreaking nature of field work, do you think concerns like exposure to pesticides and extreme heat are other important reasons why so few U.S. citizens and other legally documented workers enter into this kind of labor?
Well, absolutely. And I will say also, maybe about 10 or 15 years ago, the United Farm Workers in California, when there was again a big anti-immigrant sentiment, United Farm Workers had a campaign called Take My Job.
Right.
And they put the call out for citizen workers to come out and do the farm work. And I think one worker lasted a whole week and everybody else couldn't even last the whole day.
Yeah.
So it's brutal work and there are exposures to heat and pesticides and the conditions are just really grueling.
Yeah.
And so you're not going to get U.S. citizens to come and do that work.
Jeannie, you've worked with migrant farm workers, as you said, in Florida for 3 decades now. Most are from Latin America, especially Mexico and Central America. What's the most important thing you've learned in that time about the people who come here? What stands out most to you about their human profile, as it were?
It's personal to me. They're not just a category of worker. When you say farm workers, a lot of people just, you know, see people's backs and leaning over and harvesting food, but they're three-dimensional people. I've been to their quinceañeras. I've been to, you know, events to church and to funerals. And
right.
So
and I should point out to our listeners, the quinceañera is a Latina girl's 15th birthday.
Yes. And it's too easy to put people into a category and then dismiss them or stereotype them just because they're doing some of the hardest work in our country and because they tend to be quote unquote invisible doesn't mean that they're any less family oriented and caring, loving people. And I will say there's also a lot of Haitian farm workers in Florida too, more than in other states.
Right. Thanks for that reminder. That's a good reminder. Mm-hmm. Now, among those who are undocumented though, do they struggle with the fact that they are technically living and working in this country illegally? How do you find they reconcile with that uncomfortable reality?
Well, you know, again, I've been doing this for many, many years, and it's strange to see the fluctuation. So there have been moments over the past 30 years where there hasn't been such a focus on undocumented immigrants, and people just go about their daily lives. You have to. You know, you have joy when your kid graduates from school, or when your husband gets a pay raise, or when your family members get married. So you have your daily joys and loves and experiences. But it's always kind of in the background there that you know there's risks because of being undocumented. No. And right now, those risks really are overwhelming people. And so it kind of takes away from their daily life experiences.
We talk a lot about the economic and even tax contribution undocumented migrant workers make to Florida and the U.S., but what perhaps gets overlooked is the contribution they make to the social fabric of the communities they live in, whether it's Homestead here in Miami-Dade County, or Lake Worth Beach up in Palm Beach County, or Apopka there in Central Florida where the FWAF is headquartered. How would you describe that community contribution undocumented workers make here?
Well, I tell you, I hear from some farm workers that make jokes because they say, oh, Americans really love Mexican food right now. Everybody is opening up a Mexican restaurant, right, and yet they want the Mexicans to leave. Right. So it's kind of ironic that we celebrate their food, we celebrate their culture, Cinco de Mayo and other events, and yet we denigrate the people who bring these rich cultures to our country. So it's very ironic and it's very hypocritical that we celebrate these cultures and yet we demonize the people. And a lot of farm workers will have other jobs. They are mechanics. They have many skills that they offer to the community. And some of them do end up opening up their own businesses. It could be a restaurant. It could be a landscaping business. One of the things that we like to say is that farm workers are just landless farmers. They have skills. They have knowledge. The other thing that is a really a misconception that we would like to destroy is the fact that people call farm workers uneducated.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of them might not have formal education, but a lot of them are a lot smarter than people with formal education, and they have many skills and knowledge, and they have knowledge that maybe we don't recognize, knowledge about plants, knowledge about the weather, knowledge of their ancestral practices of farming and growing food. Mm-hmm. So there's a wealth of knowledge there that we're missing by just dismissing them as workers and undocumented or uneducated.
Right. How then is President Trump's and Governor DeSantis's sweeping deportation campaign affecting those communities from your standpoint? And how does that stand to eventually affect the rest of us?
It's incomprehensible, actually, because it's demonizing people without even knowing who they are. You know, what's really tragic is we talk about wanting to make our country better and our communities better, but if we are tearing families apart, that creates trauma, and that trauma lasts for a long time. So we are not creating stronger communities if we're tearing people and families apart. We need to build our communities up. And honestly, I'm really concerned about the future of agriculture in Florida, because agriculture is already at risk because of climate change, hurricanes, droughts, floods in agriculture. It's at risk because of overdevelopment. Farmers are selling their land to development because they can make more money selling their land than continuing to grow crops. And because of the fact that we are targeting farm workers like this. And if we keep doing that, then we're not going to have people here in agriculture anymore.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Jeannie Economos of the Farm Workers Association of Florida about the situation of migrant and especially undocumented migrant workers here as we approach Labor Day during this year of unprecedented immigration controversy. Jeannie, going back to what you were just talking about, we're seeing a big political push in the U.S. to conflate undocumented migrant labor with criminality. I would say a decade ago that was not a common thing. It is today. So aside from the heightened threat of deportation, how has the fact that undocumented migrants are being identified as criminal threats to society today affected the undocumented migrant worker communities you work with?
Well, first of all, if you look at the statistics, undocumented workers and immigrants commit a lot less crimes than the citizen population.
Right. They have a much lower rate of crime with respect to their population.
Correct. Second of all, it is demoralizing. We have kids come to us and tell us they are bullied in school oftentimes. Some children calling other children, you know, criminals because their parents came here, quote unquote, illegally. I think the public needs to know that being an undocumented immigrant in this country is not a criminal offense. It's a civil offense.
The Trump administration, though, does insist anyone here illegally is in criminal violation.
And the continued use of the word criminal related to undocumented immigrants is distorting the reality. It humiliates people. It makes people withdraw, and it really affects people's mental health. Mm-hmm. We've been trying to work with some students who are experiencing anti-immigrant rhetoric, but most of all, we just need to stop it. Just needs to stop.
What's your response, though, to folks like President Trump and Governor DeSantis when they argue that immigrant advocates like the FWAF open the door to this kind of immigration backlash by at least giving American voters the impression that you've been advocating for open borders and an uncontrolled flow of undocumented migrant workers into the U.S.?
Well, I think we need to be honest about this. The United States immigration policy is schizophrenic. When the United States, over the decades, over 100 years or more, when the United States needs workers to come into the country, they have looked the other way. And they have even encouraged undocumented workers to come in from other countries. And that's industry, agricultural industry, the railroad industry. Other industries have encouraged undocumented workers. Why? Because it's cheaper labor.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they benefit from that. Then when we get different people in power or we don't want the labor force here, then we completely change our immigration policy. So it's schizophrenic and we need to really look at that as a country.
Well, that brings me to the last question I wanted to ask you, Jeannie. From your perspective then, as someone who works with the undocumented migrant community, is the current seasonal or temporary migrant worker visa system we have in place in the U.S., the so-called H-2 visa system specifically, is it adequate to meet the needs of the labor demand we have in places like Florida in sectors like agriculture?
Let me tell you, the H-2A worker visa program is rife with abuse and labor trafficking.
Right. I should just note, though, that last year the U.S. Labor Department said it had put in place new tools to address those abuses, but the Trump administration just recently rescinded them.
So if anything, the undocumented workers here are less criminals than the criminality that's found oftentimes within the H-2A program. And we've had cases of H-2A workers who have complained to us about trafficking and horrible conditions. So that's not the answer. Besides, there are people here who have been here for decades and are solid citizens in the community. We just need to give them a pathway to citizenship. And let me say one more thing. In 2005, we came very, very close to getting comprehensive immigration reform. And it was turned around in December of 2005. And we had agriculture industry, that means farmers, landowners, the people that own agriculture, the industry, standing side by side with farm workers to try and get a bill called Ag Jobs passed. Yeah. And we almost got it passed. And it just ended because an anti-immigrant bill was introduced at the end of the year and it didn't get passed.
Is that kind of pathway politically possible today, though, when the big thing now is called gold car visas for wealthier immigrants instead of farm workers?
Well, I think we really need to seriously look at why this is happening in this country. And if we really value family values, what kind of family values is that? And what is this gold card? When we have people here who have been solid, hardworking families for decades, why are we giving gold cards to people who have not really invested their sweat equity and their families into this community?
Jeannie Economos is the Pesticide Safety and Environmental Health Project Coordinator for the nonprofit Farm Worker Association of Florida in Apopka. Jeannie, many thanks.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Finally on the roundup, a mural honoring baseball legends in Overtown is a symbol of resilience for that community. WLRN's Carla Mendez tells us about the recent racist vandalism it faced and the determined efforts of kids to restore it.
One, two, three!
Go Sea!
Go say Negro, you say me.
At Dorsey Park, children sporting baseball hats crowded in front of the newly restored mural. Close-up portraits of Jackie Robinson with his face turned in a slight side smile, and Minnie Minoso grinning in his White Sox uniform. But this summer, the mural honoring some of Miami's most iconic black baseball players was the target of hate-motivated vandalism, graffitied with swastikas and racial slurs. Among the first to spot and call out the vandalism when it emerged was 8-year-old Braden J. Floyd, who is black.
I felt threatened because I play baseball and those are famous baseball players. And I don't kind of like that because it's a threat to me and the community.
The mural was originally painted in 2011 through the MLK Mural Project with Urgent Inc., two nonprofit youth organizations. The restoration was led by Miami artist Alex Duyan, an art educator for two Miami-Dade County public schools, who worked on the original 2011 murals.
What the park has done is kind of helped to illustrate Negro League Baseball, which took place here.
The mural's restoration is part of a larger 18-month renewal project for Dorsey Park, led by Urgent Inc., with funding from the Miami Marlins. Locals say the restoration is also about investing in Overtown's future, with children helping to build community alongside the murals. I'm Carla Mendez in Miami.
That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great Labor Day weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN Public Media.